Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, December 8th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. Our theme tonight is Tennessee Homecoming. It's good to be home. I've been gone for 2.5 months, and I have to tell you, 2.5 months without your own washer dryer, that's hard to do. But I'm back home. I was repeatedly reminded throughout my travels in Europe how fond people are in Europe of the American people. They may not like the government in America. They may not like some of the corporations, particularly some of the ones controlling the food supply. But they like the American people, and they differentiate between them. And I have to say, I do too. And the Sanders family are among my favorite Americans, so it's especially good to be back in Tennessee with Franklin and his family. Before we start tonight, I wanted to remind you Christmas season is coming. We sent out our holiday greeting this week with a beautiful, beautiful picture of the Red Hot Peppers by wonderful artist Lesta Frank. She makes a picture that we use for our Christmas card every year. And, in fact, that picture is one of 12 pictures that were made for a very exciting new product that's coming to market. You'll hear about it from us some more. It's a seed library done by a wonderful entrepreneur. I'll tell you about it and later. But on the card, which we sent the update out this week, we mentioned that we have made our Christmas donation this year. Last year we did food banks. This year we made a $1,000 donation to the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. I've been a member for several years. You heard Sally Fallon when she was on the Solari Report talk about it. It's an absolutely critical effort to provide legal services to protect small farmers, particularly small farmers who are doing raw milk and organic food. And I can't recommend that organization to you enough. And so if you still have space in your holiday gifting, you might want to consider joining or gifting to the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And if you want to learn more about it, you can link to it from the update that we did this week. It's in the update section at our website. And I also wanted to remind you, if you're looking for presents for Christmas that help people sort of understand the environment and how to protect and build family wealth in this environment, we have our new DVD, Investment Strategies for Changing Time. It's a presentation I gave in Mill Valley. And it's a very good overview of sort of how to think about investment going forward. You can stream it. Subscribers, of course, can get it for free. You can stream it for free. But the public can now buy it for $15 and stream for $5. So we have that and the Solari Report. Just call Darlene or email customer service. Call Darlene at customer service, and she'll be delighted to arrange any kind of gifts you want. But I also want to put a plug in for my favorite newsletter, which is, of course, the Money Changer. It's the one that Franklin publishes every month. And it's a wonderful, it's just a wonderful newsletter with great interviews and coverage of the precious metals market. And you can get that by calling the Money Changer. So these are all great gifts, and I recommend them to you. Money and markets. I'm going to give more report when I talk with Franklin about my trip to Europe. But first, a few words. We had a great question from one of the subscribers. In the past, you've commented that you think a sort of reengineering is what is going on in Europe. After your trip over there, would you still be your characterization rather than, for example, a collapse of the Eurozone? Please share with us your thoughts on this critical matter. Everything I saw in Europe confirmed to me that what we were watching was a reengineering, just as we saw the housing and debt bubble entrap consumers and homeowners. We're watching debt entrap governments, and that sort of entrapment being used to exercise greater and greater financial control over governments, and it's all part of the shift we've talked about many times, of the shift away from sovereign governments as sort of the political control. I did two things when I was in Europe. I was at a conference for a week, and that conference was focused on how to build local communities. And it was a wonderful group of people. There were people from around the world and really wonderful people doing great things. But I found myself spending about a half of the conference in a state of terror. And I finally said to one person, One man's Echo Village is another man's prison camp. I can hear Franklin giggling in the background. And, you know, it's because my view of the world is really one of economic warfare. There are tremendous numbers of very good-hearted people who have no idea how some of their ideologies can be misused. And so you always want to be careful when you think about going local, that it's going local because that's what free individuals want to do, not something that can be used in other ways. I'm going to try and write an article reporting on the conference because I think it's a good there's a real good discussion of sort of economic models and how those economic models can be used or misused. The second week and a half, I was visiting with money managers both in Switzerland and in Austria, in Vienna, and it was a fascinating time. You see a whole group, I think it's now 12 Swiss firms who've registered with the SEC so they can continue to provide services to Americans, and you see the real sort of currency wars and economic warfare going on back and forth between America. I really have to say that what we're watching on one hand is a world that's being outmaneuvered by what I call the breakaway civilization and greater centralization. On the other hand, the world is getting smarter. You see so much anger and frustration in Europe towards what they refer to as the political class, and a realization that they really have to outlive them. And there's real admiration for certain parts of America. Coming back on the plane, I read George Friedman's new book, The Next 100 Years, and his description, he describes America as a barbaric nation. And that's what you see and feel from Switzerland as you watch the sort of currency wars and economic warfare and capital controls get fought out in thousands and thousands of tiny little rules. And more on the European situation when I talk with Franklin during Precious Metals Report. The MF Global Mystery continues with John Corzine testifying in front of the Agricultural Committee today, why the Agricultural Committee, MF Global, had many futures positions of farmers, and we see farmers all around the country who are hedging their positions, not speculating, but really hedging legitimate positions, losing money. One of the big issues here is not just that the firm went down, but the customer accounts were not protected. That's a new one for the Chicago Exchange. We had, and I posted it up on the blog, an interview with a woman who had a commodities trading firm who shut it down because of the CME's failure to protect the customer accounts. There's a lot there that I don't agree with, but I put it up because it is one point of view. Her contention is that this is a real proof that the rule of law is no longer in America. And as I said to Franklin earlier tonight at the dinner table, where has she been for the last 50 years as, the rule of law has been continually compromised? So you get, it's a description by somebody who I think is pretty clueless about how the system works, but she does communicate the outrageousness of what's happened with customer accounts and how unprecedented it is in the futures market. The question for me continues to be, was this a hit or was it simply incompetence on the part of Corzine and the board and the management team? I don't think we know. I tend to believe Corzine today in the testimony when he said he did not realize that there was a problem with customer accounts till October 29th. The fact is that could absolutely be the case, because particularly if this was a hit. Interestingly, I should mention I have great conflicts vis-a-vis Corzine because I don't think there's anybody in the world who has more reason to despise him than me. He was the person running Goldman Sachs when I was financial advisor in the HUD loan sale, so I have lots of reasons to be crosswise of Corzine. But the reality is, as I said earlier last month, you know, I hope Corzine enjoys a rule of law that I did not. U.S. consumer debt is up. Consumers increased consumer debt by almost $8 billion in October, And it looks like a lot of that includes non-revolving credit and student loans. So not a good sign about the economy if consumers are borrowing more. We had the LA City Council vote to support a constitutional amendment against corporate personhood. As many of you know, this is a topic which can drive me into the stratosphere. It takes a lot to get under my skin, but this one still does. There are a couple of issues here, and I just want to keep beating this drum. What happens in the process of a constitutional amendment? You open up that process, and a lot can get hijacked. The second thing is, what exactly is going to be involved in it? One of the things I fear is anything that might compromise Americans' right to own and build private equity and private enterprises. One of the things I saw at the conference in Switzerland is a real push to build ideology coming out of the grassroots that cuts off sort of the private person's ability to own private property and to build wealth through private property and private enterprise, which would be an absolutely dreadful development. Some good news, Elizabeth Warren is in the lead in Massachusetts, while the person instead who was appointed in her place to the Consumer Protection Agency is struggling still to get confirmed. But it's proof that good guys sometimes can win. I got an email from a subscriber this week that says, well, I guess you called it right. And in the email was news that BP has taken a position in court that Halliburton destroyed evidence after the Gulf oil spill. Why is it that that doesn't surprise us? So we're still not sure it was an accident. I think the odds are very good that it was not an accident. The National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, there's a National Defense Authorization Act every year, but this year there was language on detentions of persons in the U.S. by the military that had the Internet aflame all week long. The Senate has passed the act. It hasn't passed into law, so it hasn't passed out and been signed by the president. It says the Senate passed with a provision that excludes U.S. citizens, but a lot of the reporting on the Internet didn't really make that clear. Not surprisingly, gun sales on Black Friday were the highest they've ever been in the country. The FBI received 129,000 requests for background checks for gun purchases. That's up 32% from the last high in 2008 of 98,000. So looks like 130,000 Americans are about to get guns for Christmas. That doesn't surprise us. Our hero tonight is a very interesting situation, and it was somebody who sort of went off quietly, but someone who clearly deserves our respect a great deal. We had the CEO of American Airlines, a gentleman named, I think it's Gerald J. Arpey. It's American Airlines Chief Executive Officer and Chairman, who had fought long and hard against bankruptcy as a path that was morally wrong, and took the position that if the board was going to authorize a bankruptcy to basically sort of hurt the pension funds or save the company by sort of cutting labor contracts and cutting the sort of pension fund arrangements, that he would not rather be a part of that. And so having failed to successfully argue any more against bankruptcy, he quietly left and said, you need to get a new CEO who can go along with this because I can't. There was a very interesting editorial by Michael Lindsay, who's the president of Gordon College, about it. Arpey had gone very quietly, so we didn't hear the story, but apparently he left without any kind of big severance package or golden parachute. So an incredibly moral action and position for a man like that to take. So he's our hero of the week. So with that, now let's turn to the precious metals market report. Franklin Sanders, we've missed you.
Well, I've missed you too.
Okay, so we have a ton of questions that I'm going to ask you, but first let's go into the market. Tell us what's been happening in precious metals.
Well, silver and gold both since the August highs and the September lows have been trading into an even-sided triangle. And if you think of the nose cone of a rocket, you'll get a pretty good idea of what that looks like. And they've traded farther and farther out into that triangle, and they were pushing the upward boundary, the upper boundary of that. And then today, boom, we got this big drop, $31 for gold and nearly $1.09 for silver. But when I pulled out the chart and looked at it, the interesting thing is that neither metal fell through that bottom boundary line. So what that says to me is that they're still in good shape. Now, if they don't follow through on the downside tomorrow, that is, if they don't make new lows tomorrow or Monday, then I have to decide that the lows are behind us, and they'll be rallying in the first quarter of next year. So it was it's a very much cliff-hanging kind of thing, because the numbers are very, very close. That is, they're very, very close sitting on those lines. But if gold and silver survive at these levels, which would be like $3,150 and $1,700 for gold, as long as they hold on to those levels, they're okay. And then once gold gets through $1,800 and closes their 2 days running, I think you have to say definitely that the bottoms are behind us. Now, whether we'll see that or not, I don't know. And as I said, tomorrow is going to be a very significant day, either tomorrow or Monday. If it's going to break, if they're going to break down, they're going to break down tomorrow. And the interesting thing is, Catherine, that this came on a day on news that, in my opinion, should have driven silver and gold up. Namely, the European Central Bank made its announcement today that they were going to do actually three different things. The first thing was that they were going to reduce their bank reserve requirements by 50% from 2% to 1%, which is a fairly big move. It means it makes it much easier for banks to loan money. And then they also lowered their interest rate by 0.25% to their all-time low, which is 1%. And I'm thinking hard, trying to remember that third thing. they reduced the collateral requirements to get a loan from the European Central Bank. And really, one of the reasons that I can't remember, I was having a hard time remembering that third one, is that they're really all three so unimportant, except as drivers of inflation, that who can remember them? The market's sitting around wanting, and has been wanting for 18 months, for the Europeans to do something about their situation. Now, I wouldn't like it, but given the system that they built, the only thing they could do is to step up to the plate and say, we're going to inflate as much as we have to inflate, but we're going to get the economy going again. Now, that won't work for the long term, I understand. And it's not the best thing they could do, but it would be at least definitive action instead of inaction and indecision and piddling and fiddling and carping at each other. And that, because that kind of, that sort of indecision is exactly the thing markets cannot stand. And they get so nervous that people are bewildered. They don't know what to do. And so you get these crazy swings we have today, 400-day. The Dow was down 200 points today, but the next day it'll be up 200 points or up, 400 points, and then it falls back 600 points in the next 3 days. That shows a tremendous amount of indecision in markets, and it doesn't appear that the Europeans have anything up their sleeve that will change anything. Now, you and I have spoken about this already, but if I were a suspicious person, and heaven knows there's plenty of reason to be suspicious in the world we live in, I would say, well, look at that. The Eurocrats are manipulating the situation to increase the centralization of power in the European Union, because that's what they're advocating. That's what Merkel and Sarkozy keep advocating. They keep saying, well, we've got to have, you know, we've got to have, the union has to have centralized control over the budgets of individual states, and there have to be sanctions against those states that don't meet those budget requirements and so forth and so
right,
on.
Right, since centralization has worked so well, we need more.
Right, exactly. Since the euro has been such a steaming success, let's centralize something else. And you know, I know that sounds conspiratorial and everything, and frankly, I don't apologize for that. Because the European, the whole project of European Union since the 1954 European Coal and Steel Alliance has been directed just in that direction, and it has not increased. It has not resulted in an increase in human liberty. It's resulted in more cross-border economic activity, and that's probably good. But as far as human freedom is concerned, it's been exactly the opposite, because the European Union is just notorious for its bureaucratic rules and regulations and rule by committee. And so it's, from that standpoint, I don't care whether the euro falls apart or not.
Did you see the quote we put up this week for the update?
No.
Oh, wait, I got to go find this for you, because it's, let me just do this. While I'm just getting a quote, look at what we're saying, though, and this is in a lot of the things we've been talking about, Franklin, not just what's happening in Europe, but what's happening with the MF global situation. You have free markets, and then you have centralized powers, and they keep taking actions that shut off the liquidity in free markets,
mm-hmm.
which means everybody's more and more dependent on the liquidity from centralized control.
Right.
So if you look at CME, you know, not respecting customer accounts
mm-hmm.
scares everybody to death in the futures market. That's bad for decentralized markets. That means you're more dependent on the Fed to sort of pump out money, and the people who get that pumped out money are the ones who have more marketplace power.
Well, let me indulge my rage just a minute. you know, if if government supervision and regulation is so good, how come they didn't catch MF Global before they took $1.2 billion out of their clients' accounts? I mean, if it works, why do they keep doing that? And all it goes to show is this, Catherine. If the people you do business with have no integrity and their word is no good, all the regulation in the world won't stop them from stealing your money.
Right, and it's funny. One of the things you heard in Europe a lot was that the liquidity between the banks had frozen because nobody knew who they could trust. Nobody trusted the numbers. Nobody trusted the accounts. In other words, there's not a breakdown there's a breakdown in the fundamental integrity of the big institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Here, let me read you the quote from our update this week. The Lord's Prayer contains 70 words, the Ten Commandments, 297, the American Declaration of Independence, 1,300, and the EU Common Market Directive on the Export of Duck Eggs, 26,911. And apparently they have 23,000 such directives.
Right.
I mean, that's why you really got the feeling, talking to everybody in Switzerland and Austria, that the EU was like the rain. It was just some tyrannical thing that you just had to endure.
But see, that completely contradicts this whole idea of a common market. That's not a common market. When you have that much regulation, there's no freedom to market anything at all. All there is more and more control.
Right.
And so it's got to... At some point, the problem is at some point the control becomes so stringent and so all-embracing that it brings everything to a halt.
Right.
It's crazy.
There was a great article by Herman DeSoto. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a Peruvian economist who's
mm-hmm.
a big proponent of property rights.
Yes.
And one of the things he was talking about was how liquidity in the, you know, in America, it's called Who Owns This Mess?
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the problems, one of the reasons liquidity is sort of frozen up in the real estate market is literally, you know, there are too many serious questions about who owns what. and title and some of the issues coming out of MERS and the collateral fraud, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I keep everything I see says that there's an effort to shut off liquidity in free markets so that everybody's dependent on the liquidity in the centralized systems. And that's why, to me, one of the most important things we can do is sit down and say, okay, how are we going to create liquidity outside of the centralized systems? Because the last thing we want to do is be dependent on it.
Well, this comes back to a famous Catherineism that you've been saying to me for a long time, and that is we've come to an environment where everybody you do business with has to be somebody that you can trust your life to.
Right.
And there isn't any substitute for that. So government regulation doesn't do that.
One of the things I love the Swiss. And one of the things I felt again when I was in Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
It's funny because I was at the conference and you sort of got the feeling that they thought real change was going to come from the activists. And I have a wonderful, wonderful client who pointed out, no, it's not going to come from the activists. It's going to come from the guys on the line who know how to deal with running line operations and, you know, whether it's transportation or utilities or money or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a week talking to just wonderful money managers who are watching what's going on, and it strikes terror in their heart because, you know, the Swiss are deeply committed to property rights and deeply committed to, you know, personal financial integrity and sort of integrity of transactions. And deeply, you know, sort of committed to free markets. And, you know, so they're watching what's going on. Just, you know, but you feel the depth of their cultural commitment to run things in a manner of integrity and struggling with how to do that in this environment. But part of what you feel is this just amazingly deep cultural commitment. I don't know if you remember what you said to me about this at dinner time. You said,
no.
That's how America used to feel. Well, but that's how, if we want to build liquidity, you know, liquidity doesn't start with money. It starts with being able to make a contract and keep it. That's what liquidity is based on.
Right. And it means that life is stable to that extent. You know, I mean, what's the purpose of the rule of law? The purpose of the rule of law is to make life stable and predictable. And that's what integrity does, personal integrity does. It makes life predictable. I know what you're going to do under that situation.
Well, and if there's a problem or miscommunication, I can get it taken care of.
Right, exactly. So I don't, you know, the back to Europe, though, the problem is that you've had all of these people pointing fingers at each other, and whining back and forth, whining in front of the media, and they've just stirred up tremendous distrust in the market, distrust that they can ever come out with anything that actually will offer a solution. And the truth is, they don't really have a solution. I think the debt is so enormous that it can't be repaid. Which brings us to another topic. I think that the only solution here is a debt jubilee. That is a forgiveness of the debts, and just where you just wipe it out and say, well, we're going to start all over. And I understand that that would be difficult to do. And
well, but you're talking like a decentralized guy. I think the debt entrapment has worked. It's been very successful for what it's supposed to do. And what you've got is a situation now where, you know, the baby boomers, both in Europe and in North America, have generated a huge amount of wealth. And now the question is, how can you, how can you lower expectations and dramatically reduce the amount that they're going to be able to command for their retirement?
Oh, wait.
You don't want to give it back.
You've just brought up the sorest topic of the week. You know, Monday night, I guess, I bring things home to read, and I had a big envelope with a letter from a fellow down in Florida who frequently sends me, not terribly frequently, but does send me very good information. And he had this letter, and he said, when are you going to start talking about the government seizing pension funds? Why haven't you said anything about it? And I You
they
know,
already have.
Well, right. They run your IRA, right? But he had several articles in there, and in 2003, the Argentine government seized pension funds, pension assets, to balance its budget out of the crisis they were in. The Hungarians did that last year. Irish are talking about doing it with nearly 25 billion euros worth of pension assets there. And
Portugal
lo and behold,
just did something.
Huh? Sorry?
Portugal just
and lo and behold, I go to work the next day and I see Portugal has seized 5.6 billion euros worth of pension assets to try and balance its budget.
Right.
Now, or to do something about the deficit. Well, you think that nobody in the United States Treasury and the United States government reads the newspaper? They don't know about that.
Well, but I think you know, and we'll get into this later. I think they've been debasing the pension funds for years. So, you know, I think in America that's exactly what's been going on, but it's been going on in a much more subtle way. Now, what we saw with American Airlines and those kinds of bankruptcies is they're basically just shifting all their pension costs and shifting it into the pension benefit guarantee corporation. So they're just shifting it to the taxpayers. It's essentially what's going to happen. So labor will take a hit and taxpayers will take a hit.
And somebody got the money.
I think so. I mean,
here's the point, that somebody's got the money. There's supposedly about $16 trillion in IRAs and 401ks, and the government's debt just happens to be about that same amount. And, you know, I don't take...
No, it's I thought IRAs, I'm trying to remember, IRAs and 401ks total, it's less than that. I think you might be adding pension funds to it.
Well, I might be.
If you add IRAs, 401ks, and pension funds, it should be higher than the budget debt.
Suppose one day, they won't call it seizing the pension funds. What they'll do is they'll announce one day we're changing the rules about IRAs because so many people have lost money in the stock market and so many people have lost money.
We're going to protect you.
We're going to protect you, and so we're going to have a guaranteed, we're going to have a program that will guarantee you a retirement return, and that is you can only invest in government bonds. You can have the long-term ones or the short-term ones, but only government bonds.
Well, but here's what I think they'll do, Franklin. I think they'll sneak up on it.
Mm.
Because this is something I watch a lot, because if somebody's, particularly if they're under 59 and a half,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a 10% penalty on top of the taxes to take it out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have people who've taken it out, and I've had people who are waiting. I don't think they'll do this before the election.
You're probably right about that. But the thing that struck me in thinking about it was the inevitability of it. I just don't, you know, it's a big plum full of money hanging there like a big pinata hanging out there in the economy, and those crooks in the government are going to, somebody sooner or later is going to say, hey, why don't we take this one? Why don't we open this pinata? And, you know, there have been several, and you followed this more closely, actually, than I have, there have been several trial balloons floated in the last, four or five
right.
years.
Yeah, we've done a couple of special reports on them. They're all up on the website. And what's interesting is, see, if and when they do this, the operational issues for the different financial service providers is enormous. And so part of coming up with something that they're really... They've been trying to do two things. One is they want to come up with something that will increase the amount of people's income that they put into 401ks. So they're interested in coming up with something that will generate new cash, particularly from businesses that don't do 401ks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's issue number one. Issue number two, they're trying to come up with something that the financial service providers will go along with.
Right.
Okay, so that's number two. And that's not inconsequential because the logistics are enormous. I mean, the compliance issues are enormous. So,
oh, I don't doubt that.
That's the reason to kind of keep running trial balloons and keep running trial balloons. What you see when you're in Europe, or even when you talk to money managers in Asia and down under, what they've been doing is adding, you know, capital control after capital control after capital control after capital control that's pushing a lot of money back into the American system and making it much harder for money to leak out.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think that's the first sort of circle they want to really tighten before they move in on the 401ks and IRAs.
Well, you just made an argument for foreign exchange controls.
You know, if there's one thing I've seen is, this gets back to the Masons and the 26-step process.
Mm-hmm.
They would much rather add a 26,000-word EU directive.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, they like to do everything sneaky. They like to be invisible.
Mm-hmm.
They like to be an invisible hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think currency controls is much too blunt. I think there are too many sort of sneaky ways that they can achieve almost the same result.
Well, for example, this IRS squawking and redefining every kind of asset overseas as a foreign account that has to be reported.
Right.
And most people look at that and say, oh, no, not me. I'm not having my name sent into the IRS as having a foreign bank account.
Right.
And so they brought the money home.
Right.
Well, that's exchange controls.
Right. But it's
subtle.
It's
yeah.
subtle.
Yeah.
And they will always go for the subtle. Anyway, but
I think... Until they put you up against the wall and shoot you.
Well, think about it. I mean, I said it to dinner tonight. I sat down and I tried to count. If you look at all the drugs brought into the United States, I mean, basically after World War II, we basically figured, okay, the way we're going to finance our, you know, building multinational corporations is to open our markets up to drugs. But if you look at the number of people killed by the drug business
mm-hmm.
over the last 50 years, you know, we killed more people with crack cocaine than the Nazis ever did with concentration camps and gas chambers.
Right.
And, you know, it's quite astonishing. Not only did we, you know, kill more people than the Nazis, but we made money doing it. And when it was all said and done, we succeeded in blaming the people who got killed. No, because they were taking drugs. You know, who can feel sorry for them, right?
Right.
Huh. Anyways. Okay, so big question, important question that I grapple with every day is if somebody's out of the market and looking to get into gold, do they do all now, or do they wait? Now, you said, you know, we're close to the floor. If the floor holds, then are you saying that they should go all now?
Well, let me be more, a little more careful than I usually am. If gold and silver don't fall out of bed within the next two trading days, then I think they have bottomed. But I know this for sure. If gold goes through $1,800, and never mind what silver's doing, if gold goes through $1,800 and closes above $1,800 for 2 days, I would say that's it. And then the final confirmation you'll get will be a close above 1920. And once that happens, then you're on your way to 2350. You know, the rally toward 2350 has started.
Right.
And I really have to, you know, we're making what in effect are very fine distinctions here, the difference between 1700 and 1800 or even 1700 and 1900 compared to what I expect gold to do. Because I will be very, very surprised if gold does anything less than quadruple from here. And so if that's the case, then it really is not going to make very much difference whether I buy at 1800 or 1900 or 1700 for that.
Right. My one concern is I think there's a reasonable chance before the end of 2012 we could get a big deflationary drop like a 2008 scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens, you know, I want to be sitting on some cash.
Well, I agree with that. And that my worry all along in watching this market has been, are we going to repeat 2008?
Right.
Is the crisis in Europe going to give us a repeat of 2008? Because if that's the case, you're right. Having a substantial amount of cash held back to make the investment that will be wise. But right. now, again, I think, you know, the 1800 and the 1920 levels are, they're going to settle all those questions. They're going to answer those questions because when gold gets up over those levels, it's going to be pretty hard to argue that it's going further down.
Right. I think part of what I know sort of my team is struggling with is, you know, we expected a stronger fourth quarter and we haven't gotten it.
You mean from gold?
Yeah.
Well, there's this ongoing crisis in Europe. You know, really, if you look at what happened the last time, it really has been pretty strong.
Right.
And by the last time, I mean 2008. But the market is basically going sideways. If you
right.
look at the golden, if you look at the Dow and gold dollars, you'll see that it's been it went down to a new low several months ago, and then it's been trading right around the 145 gold dollar level, which is about 7 ounces, and it's flat. Well, it only does that when the market goes dead, because usually gold and the Dow don't trend in the same direction. So the reason that it's flat, in my opinion, is because the gold has been in this sort of extended correction. But once that Dow and gold dollars breaks down again, goes down toward, you know, 120 gold dollars, then you know that gold is getting ready to move again.
Do you think the MF Global situation has had any impact on the gold price?
I don't have any information sources that would tell me that, but I would suspect that whatever effect it had was in those first few days in the scuffle to try and, you know, when the CME was trying to figure out what belonged to whom and was scratching around then. I don't think it's had any big effect, no.
Right. Okay. Now, it's one of the things I wanted to bring up with you was the campaign.
Ah, yes.
I had a subscriber, wonderful subscriber in Europe. You know, I think I'm the most suspicious person in the world, but they came up with a scenario that I hadn't thought of. And we were talking about how, you know, sort of painful it was to watch Ron Paul receive so much popular support and yet, you know, watch this group of sort of the seven dwarfs get all the media attention. And they said to me, well, don't you think that the likely scenario is it's all being set up for Jeb Bush to come in and save the day towards the end of the Republican nomination? And that's when I realized, you know, that there is something worse than Newt Gingrich.
And it's not John Huntsman.
No.
Yeah.
I thought,
well, you know, the astounding thing is the way that they have shifted their focus. That you can see it in the media. They completely ignore Ron Paul. Completely ignore.
It's pretty unbelievable.
It's just astounding that anyone with as much strength who raises as much money as he does would be completely ignored. And then, but they shift their focus from one to the other. First, it's Mitt Romney. Well, you know, getting excited about Mitt Romney is like getting excited about glue and wet newspaper to the wall.
Well, if Jeb Bush is the alternative, I can get excited about Mitt Romney.
Well, okay. All right. It can always get worse, right?
Right.
You know, he was the front runner for a while. And he's the quintessential political insider and technocrat and completely boring. And then they started pumping up that old retread Newt Gingrich. And, I mean, who is, you know, he's a traitor from the bottom of his
seat. He's a Freddie Mac lobbyist.
Yeah. I mean, what are you talking about? So anyway, but they, you know, all these are presidential timber now. And it's just ridiculous.
So here's the $64,000 question. If Jeb Bush is the Republican nominee, are you and I going to raise money for Obama?
Yeah. I always wondered what would drive me to that.
Okay, we've got some great questions, so I want to put some questions to you. Actually, this one is probably for me. A question, will Fast and Furious lead to impeaching the President of the United States? Not a chance. If you want to really see how drugs can relate to the impeaching of a president, you want to study the narcotics trafficking relationship on the Clinton impeachment. And it's what's really interesting was that at the last moment in the impeachment, the legislatures voted for impeachment, and an hour after it passed, I think, Clinton had the CIA put up the Inspector General's report on narcotics trafficking into Los Angeles by the CIA. And shortly thereafter, the Republicans announced that they would go through the impeachment process, but Clinton wouldn't be impeached. And the reason was that the Republicans were far dirtier on the drugs than the Democrats, but of course both parties were dirty as all get out. And the reality is, if you look at the economics of narcotics trafficking, it's a very significant business. It's very ingrained both in government, the black budget, and the financial system. We're the global leader, laundering over $1 trillion a year of all dirty money. So this is a business upon which the economics of America are deeply financially dependent. And so it's inconceivable to me that the president will be impeach for basically an operation that Fast and Furious relates to the Mexican drug cartels. So I think the answer is no, absolutely not. Although as Holder has to testify, and there's all sorts of jockeying around it, the multiple personality disorder between what we say we do and what we do are gonna come out. Anything you want to add to that, Franklin?
No.
Okay.
I'm as convinced as you are that drug dealing is embedded in the United States government, and at any point, if it gets close to exposure, it'll be covered up. I had a customer who was an airline pilot, and he told me one time, you know, they were flying in a lot of drugs to the supposedly flying in a lot of drugs to the airport at Mena, Arkansas.
Uh huh.
He said, I flew in that place one time, he said, and it's got a real short runway, and there's a mountain at the end of it. He said, if one of those planes ever hits that mountain, there'll be enough cocaine spread over all over Arkansas to look like a snowstorm hit the whole state.
If you haven't, I strongly recommend, if you're interested in all of this, that you read my story, Narco Dollars for Beginners. Mm. If you check into the article section, you can find it, and then Dylan Reed in the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. And that has some great links in the resource section, all the sort of best things to read on the involvement of the U.S. government in narcotics trafficking and the Clinton, Mena, Arkansas story, which is quite a doozy. Next question. As Chinese workers watch the rest of the world revolt and liberate, and as more attention is brought on them with things like the play The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, when will the revolt start in China and how big will it get? What are the implications on the world economy? I got a lot to say on that, but do you want to take it, Franklin?
Well, number one, I'm an unbeliever. I'm one of the few people who does not believe in the Chinese economic miracle. And the reason is because I've been listening to stories for the last 10 or 15 years about the misdirection of capital in China, building complete huge cardboard box plants out in the middle of nowhere and then never using them. How much of that is in the Chinese economy? I don't know. But I think that you got the crack in the facade this week when the Chinese government announced that it was lowering bank reserve requirements. They're in trouble.
Yeah.
How much trouble you never know because they don't publish. Their statistics are even less reliable than U.S. government statistics. So, I also don't believe in spontaneous revolutions. So the Arab Spring, the whole Arab Spring thing, somebody organized that.
Right, that's engineered.
Yeah, right.
Right. I will say, I think the George Friedman's book, The Next 100 Years, one of the strengths is he talks a lot about the fact that the number one political challenge of China is dealing with unemployment. You've got 1 billion people,
mm-hmm.
and trying to keep them employed, particularly in a world where technology deflates labor, is very, very challenging and will continue to be their weakness. And so, you know, do they misdirect a lot of capital into keeping people employed? You bet they do. Next question, if QE3 starts in January, what will that mean for the stocks and precious metals? How dramatic will be the inflationary impact? That's yours.
Well, you know, you don't know how much QE3 they'll do, but I think the answer to that is they've never stopped inflating. They just inflate at greater speeds, and whenever there's a deflationary scare, then they speed up. The Fed typically speeds up the amount of inflating that it's done. So I think you're going to get, the end of the deflation scare will come sometime before the first half of next year, and then the inflation will really start in earnest. And I fully expect to see gold next year at $2,300,
$2,400. Yeah, I think inflation, though, could be tough on stocks. Now, it's not one stock market. It's going to be, you know, so hard stocks, natural resources, precious metal stocks could do better.
Mm-hmm.
But I think inflation is going to be tough on a lot of enterprises. And I think you really need to keep that in mind. So, yes, it could push the stock market up, but it could really wreak havoc with a lot of enterprises.
Right.
So, and I think a very inflationary environment is one where it's very hard to, you know, start a company, build a company, take a company public. And so I think it's going to be mixed for the stock market and sort of change the relative values of lots of different companies in different places.
Right. But, I would like to make the point that inflation will drive up stock prices.
Yes.
It'll drive up stock indices. But
yes.
Usually it's an illusory gain in the case of the indices.
Right.
And, of course, some companies will benefit from inflation and some won't, and namely those will benefit who can keep raising their prices.
So it's people with inelastic demand for the product.
Right.
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 We had a very long post to last week I interviewed Foster Gamble, the producer and writer and narrator of Thrive. And we had a very long post from someone at that blog post, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically what he was describing was that the premise by Foster in Thrive that the world is run by a small group of families was just not the case. And this is an issue that I've seen many, many people walk up and start to face what's going on and then back off and say, no, it's a big planet, it's really complicated, a few people can't really control. If you take the time to go read that long post, you know, I have to tell you that although the person who wrote it was very thoughtful and it's very interesting, you know, I have to say that I think their point of view is complete, I hate to be rude, but bunk. And I want to tell a series of stories that will tell you why I absolutely agree with Foster that the world is run by a small group of, at a minimum, people. And the question is sort of how are they able to do it and who's really in control? And that's something I don't have an answer with. But let me tell you these stories. The first one is in the Dylan Reed story that you can read at dunwalkie.com. I was talking to another partner at Dylan Reed, and remarking that our new president, John Berkland, was not somebody, not the kind of person I would expect Nick Brady, who was the chairman, to hire. And the partner I was talking to was the son of a former chairman of Dylan Reed, and so was very knowledgeable about the inside machinations of the firm. And he said, oh, well, Brady didn't pick John Berkland. He's a Rothschild man. The Rothschilds picked Berkland to be our president. And I looked at him and I said, but we own the firm. What do the Rothschilds have to do with us? And he looked at me like I was the stupidest person in the world and just rolled his eyes and walked off. because he didn't want to say anything he could be quoted on.
Mm-hmm.
But the implication was clearly, you fool, don't you know the Rothschilds run everything? Okay, so the partners at Dillon Reed owned the firm, and yet the Rothschilds were appointing our president. Okay, and that was in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's story number one. Story number two, which is also in the Dillon Reed story, was I was in a meeting with pension fund managers in the spring of 1997, including the president of CalPERS, which is the largest pension fund in the country. And he proceeded to tell me that it was too late to save the country. I was giving him a presentation on how we could re-engineer government investment and dramatically increase wealth in a way that would benefit the pension funds and therefore provide for the retirement of America. And he said, you don't understand, it's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall. Well, CalPERS then proceeded to finance the housing bubble, buying huge amounts of mortgage paper that they knew would be debased and they knew or they knew would default. You know, the pension funds took huge losses on the housing bubble bust, and they certainly got debased like crazy on holding fixed income. Now, the president of CalPERS statements to me make it clear that they knew that that was not in their beneficiaries' interest, and yet they were doing it. And the implication was that instead of obeying the law, their investment strategy was being dictated outside the benefit or the interests of beneficiaries by forces outside. So how could that be the case? How could pension funds have invested a huge amount of money in a way that debased their beneficiaries or lost their money? Why would they do that if the system wasn't centrally controlled and they weren't literally forced to do that? Okay, so that's story number two. Story number three, which I don't think, Franklin, you'd heard before dinner, was I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing, and I was confirmed in the beginning of 1989. It was April 1989, and I had a party to celebrate the confirmation because it was a big deal trying to get the confirmation. It was a very political environment, and people were being held up. And it just so happened that the RTC, the bill authorizing the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was the law that dictated how the S&L crisis would be worked out. And so the U.S. government ended up owning $500 billion of defaulted S&L and other financial institution assets and mortgages and defaulted mortgages and then auctioning them off. And so the Undersecretary of Treasury called me and he said, I've got some people who've been working on the legislation with me. Can they join me? When Richard Breeden, who was running the SEC, came over and Bob Glauber came over, and he brought one of the guys with him who sat next to me at dinner. Bob was at my table. And so I said to the guy, you know, who are you? And he said, oh, I work for Max Warburg. So I thought, what is Max Warburg's guy from Germany over here writing our financial legislation? What's that about? Anyway, so those are three stories, but they're three of the stories that led me to believe that things were remarkably centralized and remarkably controlled by an invisible hand that tries very hard to be invisible, but I assure you it's very intelligent, it's very capable, and it's very far-thinking, and its greatest power is that we can't see it.
May I add one little story? Yeah, I think it's an amazing coincidence for people, even for people who believe in the randomness of history, to swallow. But one of the people who was behind the foundation of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Federal Reserve System and the first chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve was a fellow named Paul Warburg.
Yeah, Max's ancestor.
Right. And also a Rothschild grandson. And he had a brother named Max. And Max, at the time of World War I, Max was the head of the German Central Bank, the Reichsbank, and while Paul was the head of the American Federal Reserve System. Just a coincidence that these two brothers, all right, who both are grandchildren of the Rothschilds, happen to be in power at the same time. Isn't it an interesting coincidence?
Okay, so next Precious Metals Market Report, I'm going to tell you the story of how I met how I met Max Warburg, which I did several years later. You know who introduced me to Max? Imelda Marcos.
Oh, come on.
Now I'll tell you the story in the next Precious Metals Market Report. Okay, so any words before we close? What do you expect to see over the next month in the Precious Metals Market Report?
Well, remember that December usually finishes as a strong month for precious metals. Now, not always, but there's a very strong seasonal pattern for that. And it is not unusual. In fact, it's more than 60% the case that the year that December closes with the highest for the previous 12 months, highest prices for the previous 12 months. So I really think it's time that we reach that bottom here early in December, and then you can expect to see things roaring up off of that bottom for the balance of the month.
I hope you're right.
Well, I think so. You'll know within the next couple of days.
Yeah. No, we'll watch it carefully the next couple of days. Okay, quickly, let's go to the movies. I posted a very interesting documentary that I really recommend, particularly for those of you who had the opportunity to listen to Bill Tiller, our interview with Bill Tiller a couple of weeks ago on the Solari Report. It's called Water, the Great Mystery. And, you know, water really is one of the most important assets on the planet. And it's quite interesting because it talks a lot about the behavior of water and the behavior of water in our body, because you and I are mostly made up of water, and the relationship between our water and each other's water and the water on the planet. It's a reminder that we are quite sensitive and connected and powerful. So I recommend it to you, Water, the Great Mystery. It's free up on the internet. And then finally, in closing, December 15th, coming up, Dr. Peter Dale Scott on Deep Politics. Peter is a brilliant retired professor from Berkeley. He's got a new book called The War Machine. It's really, I recommend it highly. Then January 5th, year-end wrap-up. If there's anything you want me to cover in the year-end wrap-up, please let me know. Post the questions at the blog or post them, send them into communicate@solari.com. Great, great questions coming in. And then we'll be back with Franklin for the Precious Metals Market Report on January 13th. And I just want to mention January 20th, we'll be talking with Lynn McTaggart, author of The Field and a new book, The Bond. Very, very interesting book. So a lot coming up. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. And after listening to Franklin and me tonight, you should know that there is a conspiracy. But if you're not in a conspiracy, then you definitely need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.